Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. This is a very special 1 hour on the recent debate between presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And so I wanted to spend some time today kind of taking us away from the normal course of events we talk about in Iran, women's rights, although all of these things in some way dovetail into this conversation. So I hope that you'll hang with me for the next hour, because this upcoming election is one of the most important elections I can even remember. I remember when I first voted way back. I think it was Jimmy Carter, that election way back in 1976. Now I'm dating myself, ain't I? But I want to just tell you, based on all the experience and everything that I have watched, and being a conservative Christian, I know without a doubt that this election has some of the greatest ramifications in our political discourse, in our society, in our world. With who we vote for is going to determine so many outcomes, so many changes. The first half, I want to talk to you about the debate. I want to make some observations. I want to talk to you about some of the powerful special moments, and we'll discuss that. The second half of the program is most important. From a Christian point of view, I want to talk to you about the sovereignty of God. In other words, how important is our human vote when it comes to God, who I believe is in control of all events in the world, that he is the king of the universe? Does it matter who we vote for? Does it matter if we vote at all? What will happen? And so I'm going to discuss that whole important topic with you, because this is, like I said before, is one of the most important elections of our lifetime. Now, that being said, this is debate number one of three debates. The second debate will take place right here where I live, at Washington University in St. Louis on October 9th. And unfortunately, both Becky and I are working, so once again, we will have to depend on social media to know what's going on. I would love to be at that debate coming up in October 9th. Of course, just around the corner here, I think on Tuesday, is the vice presidential debate between Pence and Kane. So that will look to be a very interesting debate as well. And so lots of things are happening, and I want to begin today by mentioning a few things just from my observation on the debate on Monday. It's very evident to me and to very many other political commentators that Lester Holt was very, very biased in his approach. He was very tied emotionally and politically to Hillary Clinton, and you could tell by the way he interrupted Donald Trump some 61 times compared to the 6 times he interrupted Hillary Clinton. And it just seems like he controlled a lot of the outcome of the answers and the assortment of questions. Notice in the first debate, and you can go back and watch it, where was Benghazi ever mentioned? What about the email scandals other than what Trump said? What about the Clinton Foundation? What about anything tied to any kind of criminal activity with Hillary Clinton? The emails, Benghazi, the Clinton Foundation, her health record. All of these things suddenly vanished from the first debate. And none of those issues were raised. And I'm here to tell you, when it comes to debate number two, I believe Donald Trump is going to take advantage of all of those little missed opportunities that he had in the first debate. Remember something about Donald Trump. He doesn't have real debate experience. Well, now he does. But this is something very new to him, and so he's learning. He had some debate prep experience with the primaries, but I'm talking one-on-one debate experience. I think he did quite well. I thought he held his ground. I thought he pushed the issue when necessary. He had some missed opportunities when he could have interjected something about women's rights, Saudi Arabia, more about the emails, more something about Benghazi. Those are missed opportunities that I believe in the second debate he will not let slide by him. I believe that he has learned something in the first debate, and I think that he will do everything he can to push the issue in debate number two and, of course, three. And according to a lot of polls, a lot of on-site conservative magazines and websites and groups, Donald Trump, according to them, won that first debate. And, of course, CNN is going to say that Hillary won. They're in the bed with Hillary. Notice that when you talk to most people, the media controls their thinking. The media very decidedly is on her side. And so with all of this information that I've shared with you so far, what I want to do right now, with that in mind, I want to play about a 2-minute, 20-second debate highlight reel just to give you a feel and a flavor of what went on. Now, maybe you haven't even seen the first debate. If not, this will give you a feel, like I said, and a flavor of what went on. So here we're going to hear a debate highlight reel for the next couple of minutes right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
But we have to stop our jobs from being stolen from us. We have to stop our companies from leaving.
I call it trumped up trickle down, because that's exactly what it would be.
Our country is suffering because people like Secretary Clinton have made such bad decisions in terms of our jobs and in terms of what's going on.
At the end of this evening, I'm going to be blamed for everything that's ever happened.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah, why not?
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted, as soon as she releases them, I will release my tax returns.
Why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be.
We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases, they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns, and they shoot people. And we have to be very strong, and we have to bring back law and order. Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well, Mayor Giuliani is here, it worked very well in New York.
And it's just a fact that if you're a young African-American man and you do the same thing as a young white man, you are more likely to be arrested, charged, convicted, and incarcerated.
I think that I've developed very, very good relationships over the last little while with the African-American community.
But remember, Donald started his career back in 1973 being sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination.
You look at the Middle East, it's a total mess, under your direction to a large extent. I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament. Hillary has experience, but it's bad experience.
I hope the people out there understand this election's really up to you. It's not about us so much as it is about you and your families and the kind of country and future you want.
Interesting point that Hillary makes. In fact, it's one thing to remember when you vote. This is about your house, your life, your future. Your vote is going to determine, really, in many ways, what life is going to be like in our country for the next at least 4 years. And so it has ramifications. And really do yourself a favor and do your country a favor and go out and vote on November 8th. Those were some interesting snippets and highlights from Monday night, but I want to go to what I think was perhaps one of the finest moments for Donald Trump when he was once again attacked about failing to disclose his tax record. Now, at that point, I thought his answer was insightful, but I thought he should have also challenged Hillary to give up her medical health information, to make that public, which she fails to do. Look at all the incidents of sickness, illness, and seizures, if you look carefully at some of these video clips, that Hillary has suffered in this past cycle of election, and yet nothing is coming forward, really, about her present health condition, other than the fact that she supposedly had pneumonia a few weeks ago. But I think the public needs to have that information, and so I would say that Donald should have mentioned this, but he did mention the emails, and I want you to hear what I thought was one of his best moments in the debate right now on the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
The IRS has an audit of your taxes. You're perfectly free to release your taxes during an audit. And so the question, does the public's right to know outweigh your personal...
Well, I told you, I will release them as soon as the audit. Look, I've been under audit almost for 15 years. I know a lot of wealthy people that have never been audited. I said, do you get audited? I get audited almost every year. And in a way, I should be complaining. I'm not even complaining. I don't mind it. It's almost become a way of life. I get audited by the IRS, but other people don't. I will say this. We have a situation in this country that has to be taken care of. I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted, as soon as she releases them, I will release my tax returns. And that's against my lawyers. They say don't. But I will tell you this. No, in fact, watching shows, reading the papers, almost every lawyer says you don't release your returns until the audit's complete. When the audit's complete, I'll do it. But I would go against them if she releases her
emails. So it's negotiable?
It's not negotiable. No, let her release the email. Why did she delete 33,000?
And right there, I wish we would have continued that conversation about the email scandal and what Hillary did by setting up a private server and by deceiving and hiding and giving false information to the FBI inquest, if you will. And she lied continuously about not actually sending confidential classified emails. She lied about the number of devices that she had. She lied about not turning over everything. She claimed she turned over everything. Almost everything that Hillary said was contradicted by James Comey when he was asked later on at the Senate investigation of specific questions. And so it's very clear to me that she's not an honest woman. This is why one of the main reasons I'm not voting for her, she's not trustworthy. Someone like her that would compromise the very secure fabric of our nation for political gain and power is not fit to be president. And so I thought that Donald Trump's challenge was a good moment in the debate where he said, look, I will do exactly what you and the public is asking me to do, but specifically you, Hillary, if you are willing to come clean with the 33,000 emails that you deleted and disclose them, I will disclose my tax records. Now, this next sound clip is an interesting one because one of the main points in this sound clip is what Donald Trump says to Hillary, and you'll hear this as the conversation develops. Hillary, you have been in politics for 30-plus years. What have you done? You've never had a plan. What have you done in these past 30 years? This is about a five-minute-long conversation. It's about economic policies. And so I want you to carefully listen because I thought it was another good moment in the debate for Donald Trump. Let's listen.
So I will tell you this. We have to do a much better job at keeping our jobs. And we have to do a much better job at giving companies incentive to build new companies or to expand because they're not doing it. And all you have to do is look at Michigan and look at Ohio and look at all of these places where so many of their jobs and their companies are just leaving. They're gone. And Hillary, I just ask you this. You've been doing this for 30 years. Why are you just thinking about these solutions right now? For 30 years you've been doing it, and now you're just starting to think of solutions.
Well, actually,
I will bring back jobs. You can't bring back jobs.
Well, actually, I have thought about this quite a bit.
Yeah, for 30 years.
I have, not quite that long. I think my husband did a pretty good job in the 1990s. I think a lot about what worked and how we can make it work again.
Well, he approved NAFTA.
3 million new jobs.
He approved
NAFTA, balanced budget,
which is the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country.
Incomes went up for everybody. Manufacturing jobs went up also in the 1990s, if we're actually going to look at the facts. When I was in the Senate, I had a number of trade deals that came before me, and I held them all to the same test. Will they create jobs in America? Will they raise incomes in America? And are they good for our national security? Some of them I voted for. The biggest one, a multinational one known as CAFTA, I voted against. And because I hold the same standards as I look at all of these trade deals. But let's not assume that trade is the only challenge we have in the economy. I think it is a part of it, and I've said what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a special prosecutor. We're going to enforce the trade deals we have, and we're going to hold people accountable. When I was Secretary of State, we actually increased American exports globally 30%. We increased them to China 50%. So I know how to really work to get new jobs and to get exports that help to create more new jobs.
Well, you haven't done it in 30 years or 26 years,
well,
any number you want to do.
I've been a senator,
you
Donald,
haven't done it.
And
you haven't
I
done
have
it.
Been a
and
Secretary of State, and I have
your
done
Your husband signed NAFTA,
lot.
Which was one of the worst things that ever happened
well,
to the manufacturing industry.
That is your
you
opinion.
You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing is down 30, 40, sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And now you want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate. But you know that if you did win, you would approve that, and that will be almost as bad as NAFTA. Nothing will ever top NAFTA.
That is just not accurate. I was against it once it was finally negotiated and the terms were laid out. I wrote about that in...
You called it the gold standard. You called it the gold standard of trade deals. You said it's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
Well, Donald, I know you live in your own reality, but that is not the facts. The facts are, I did say, I hoped it would be a good deal, but when it was negotiated, which I was not responsible for, I concluded it wasn't. I wrote about that.
So is it President Obama's fault? Is it President Obama's
you
fault?
Even announced. Look, there
Secretary,
are
Secretary, is it President
there,
Obama's fault?
There are
Because he's pushing it.
There are different views about what's good for our country, our economy, and our leadership in the world. And I think it's important to look at what we need to do to get the economy going again. That's why I said new jobs with rising incomes, investments, not in more tax cuts that would add $5 trillion to the debt.
But you have no plan.
Oh, I do.
Secretary, you have no plan.
A book about it. It's called Stronger Together. You can pick it up tomorrow.
That's about all you
folks. At the bookstore or at an airport near you.
We're going to move to.
But it's because I see this. We need to have strong growth, fair growth, sustained growth. We also have to look at how we help families balance the responsibilities at home and the responsibilities at business. So we have a very robust set of plans, and people who have looked at both of our plans have concluded that mine would create 10 million jobs and yours would lose us 3.5 million jobs and explode.
You are going to approve one of the biggest tax cuts in history. You are going to approve one of the biggest tax increases in history. You are going to drive business out. Your regulations are a disaster, and you're going to increase regulations all over the place. And by the way, my tax cut is the biggest since Ronald Reagan. I'm very proud of it. It will create tremendous numbers of new jobs. But regulations, you are going to regulate these businesses out of existence. When I go around, Lester, I tell you this, I've been all over. And when I go around, despite the tax cut, the things that businesses and people like the most is the fact that I'm cutting regulation. You have regulations on top of regulations, and new companies cannot form, and old companies are going out of business, and you want to increase the regulations and make them even worse. I'm going to cut regulations, but I'm going to cut taxes big league, and you're going to raise taxes big league. End of story.
Let me get you to...
The Democratic worldview is to raise taxes on everyone, create more social programs, more regulations, throw money at problems, and destroy our economy. And yet, when Donald Trump talks about the biggest tax cut, and you can look back in history, when Ronald Reagan became president, he empowered Americans through tax cut. We got out of the economic deluge created by President Carter. And now that's exactly what Donald Trump wants to do if he becomes president, is to empower people again, to take away all of the government regulations and free up the small businesses. And yet, no, not according to Hillary, because the liberal agenda is always to keep people dependent on government by securing their obedience by just more taxation, more social programs, more regulations, more political correctness. I thought that was a good exchange by Donald Trump, him pointing out you've been around Hillary for 30 years. You haven't done anything. You don't have a plan. This next subject is near and dear to my heart. The Iran deal was a denial of the human rights of the people of Iran. Everything was about the Iran deal, where we sold our soul to the greatest terrorist threat in the world, that is Iran. And by signing this deal, we empowered them through all of the sanction relief to empower their terrorist grip on the world through Hezbollah and many others. It was the worst deal in the world. And I thought this was a good exchange, especially Donald Trump's point about this policy. Let's listen to this next segment of the debate.
Still on the subject of securing America on nuclear weapons, President Obama reportedly considered changing the nation's longstanding policy on first use. Do you support the current policy? Mr. Trump, you have 2 minutes on that.
Well, I have to say that, for what Secretary Clinton was saying about nuclear with Russia, she's very cavalier in the way she talks about various countries. But Russia has been expanding. They have a much newer capability than we do. We have not been updating from the new standpoint. I looked the other night, I was seeing B-52s. They're old enough that your father, your grandfather could be flying them. We are not keeping up with other countries. I would like everybody to end it, just get rid of it, but I would certainly not do first strike. I think that once the nuclear alternative happens, it's over. At the same time, we have to be prepared. I can't take anything off the table, because you look at some of these countries, you look at North Korea, we're doing nothing there. China should solve that problem for us. China should go into North Korea. China is totally powerful as it relates to North Korea. And by the way, another one powerful is the worst deal I think I've ever seen negotiated that you started is the Iran deal. Iran is one of their biggest trading partners. Iran has power over North Korea. And when they made that horrible deal with Iran, they should have included the fact that they do something with respect to North Korea. And they should have done something with respect to Yemen and all these other places. And when asked to Secretary Kerry, why didn't you do that? Why didn't you add other things into the deal? One of the great giveaways of all time, including $400 million in cash Nobody's ever seen that before. That turned out to be wrong. It was actually $1.7 billion in cash. Obviously, I guess, for the hostages, it certainly looks that way. So you say to yourself, why didn't they make the right deal? This is one of the worst deals ever made by any country in history. The deal with Iran will lead to nuclear problems. All they have to do is sit back 10 years, and they don't have to do much, and they're going to end up getting nuclear. I met with Bibi Netanyahu the other day. Believe me, he is not a happy camper.
All right. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, you have 2 minutes.
Let me start by saying words matter. Words matter when you run for president, and they really matter when you are president. And I want to reassure our allies in Japan and South Korea and elsewhere that we have mutual defense treaties, and we will honor them. It is essential that America's word be good. And so I know that this campaign has caused some questioning and some worries on the part of many leaders across the globe. I've talked with a number of them. But I want to, on behalf of myself, and I think on behalf of a majority of the American people, say that, you know, our word is good. It's also important that we look at the entire global situation. There's no doubt that we have other problems with Iran, but personally, I'd rather deal with the other problems having put that lid on their nuclear program than still to be facing that. And Donald never tells you what he would do. Would he have started a war? Would he have bombed Iran? If he's going to criticize a deal that has been very successful in giving us access to Iranian facilities that we never had before, then he should tell us what his alternative would be. But it's like his plan to defeat ISIS. He says it's a secret plan, but the only secret is that he has no plan. So we need to be more precise in how we talk about these issues. People around the world follow our presidential campaigns so closely, trying to get hints about what we will do. Can they rely on us? Are we going to lead the world with strength and in accordance with our values? That's what I intend to do. I intend to be a leader of our country that people can count on, both here at home and around the world, to make decisions that will further peace and prosperity, but also stand up to bullies, whether they're abroad or at home. We cannot let those who would try to destabilize the world, to interfere with American interests and security, to be given any opportunities at all.
Well, I thought that what Donald Trump originally said about the deal, I completely agree. It was a disaster. It empowered the terrorist government of Iran. It did not deal with the subject of human rights. These people are suffering day and night under Khamenei and Rouhani. Nothing was said, nothing was done to reach out and to try to make an impact on that government, that regime, to stop torturing and destroying their people. But again, I want to move on here because of our time. The situation in Charlotte and other cities of the world is very sad and tragic and tense. That being said, I want to talk on this soundbite about law and order and what Donald Trump said. If you go see the movie Hillary's America, you will have a bird's eye view, an upfront view of really the Democratic strategy in the inner cities. What have they done for the black people? They have manipulated them. They've taken advantage of their vote, and they have done nothing to make a change in the inner cities with the crimes, the drugs. It seems like they do this to ensure they will have them as a voting block on election day, but they do nothing, absolutely nothing, to change the lives of these people that are suffering. Most families, single parents, no father, and we wonder why the things that are happening today are happening. There needs to be a change. Donald Trump has reached out to the black African-American community. He was welcomed at a church in Detroit. He is doing his part to reach out to them and to try his best to understand their situation. But what I thought he had to say about the recent tragedy going on in Charlotte was very insightful. And I like what he had to say about stop and frisk. Let's listen to this soundbite right now on the debate we're talking about.
If we don't have it, we're not going to have a country. And when I look at what's going on in Charlotte, a city I love, a city where I have investments, when I look at what's going on throughout various parts of our country, whether it's, I mean, I can just keep naming them all day long. We need law and order in our country. And I just got today the, as you know, the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police. We just came in. We have endorsements from, I think, almost every police group, a large percentage of them in the United States. We have a situation where we have our inner cities, African Americans, Hispanics, are living in hell because it's so dangerous. You walk down the street, you get shot. In Chicago, they've had thousands of shootings, thousands, since January 1st. Thousands of shootings. And I'm saying, where is this? Is this a war-torn country? What are we doing? And we have to stop the violence. We have to bring back law and order. In a place like Chicago, where thousands of people have been killed, thousands over the last number of years. In fact, almost 4,000 have been killed since Barack Obama became president. Almost 4,000 people in Chicago have been killed. We have to bring back law and order. Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well, Mayor Giuliani is here, it worked very well in New York, it brought the crime rate way down. But you take the gun away from criminals that shouldn't be having it. We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases, they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns, and they shoot people. And we have to be very strong, and we have to be very vigilant. We have to know what we're doing. Right now, our police, in many cases, are afraid to do anything. We have to protect our inner cities because African-American communities are being decimated by crime.
Your 2 minutes has expired, but I do want to...
Yes, and again, I want to reiterate my point before I played that for you. What has the Democratic Party done for the black people in the last 40 or plus years? What have they done to make a change in the environment there? What have they done for the inner cities and education? What have they done about crime? They want to take away everyone's guns. Hillary Clinton, of course, is certainly really not a Second Amendment supporter. She tries to vacillate around that. She hates the NRA because the NRA wants to uphold our Second Amendment. And so Hillary's America of law and order is more restrictions, more regulations, more manipulation, and no change, and no policy changes, and no changes in the inner city. This is the last soundbite from the debate I want to play, and I thought it was a very stellar moment, a very good moment for Donald Trump. He could have went further. He explained at the end he wasn't going to raise the women's issue. But I want to talk about the idea of Hillary having the stamina to become president. Well, the first thing you and I need to know about is her current health condition. We hear so much about Donald Trump's tax records. What about her health records? Every doctor that I've seen that has investigated and analyzed the video of Hillary looking like she's having a seizure or propped up against a pole waiting for the car to come on the 9/11 day, all of them have concluded that she has some kind of neurological problems going on that she's not willing to disclose. And so what I think what Donald Trump does here in the final segment is very important for the American voter. Will they want to have a president that is unable physically and mentally and competently to handle the job? And I thought this exchange was a good exchange. We're going to listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Trump, this year, Secretary Clinton became the first woman nominated for president by a major party. Earlier this month, you said she doesn't have, quote, a presidential look. She's standing here right now. What did you mean by that?
She doesn't have the look. She doesn't have the stamina. I said she doesn't have the stamina. And I don't believe she does have the stamina. To be president of this country, you need tremendous stamina.
The quote was,
you
I
have,
just don't think
wait,
she has
wait a minute,
unless
you ask
look.
Me a question. Did you ask me a question? You have to be able to negotiate our trade deals. You have to be able to negotiate, that's right, with Japan. with Saudi Arabia. I mean, can you imagine we're defending Saudi Arabia, and with all of the money they have, we're defending them, and they're not paying? All you have to do is speak to them. Wait, you have so many different things you have to be able to do, and I don't believe that Hillary has the stamina.
Let's let her respond.
Well, as soon as he travels to 112 countries and negotiates a peace deal, a ceasefire, a release of dissidents, an opening of new opportunities in nations around the world, or even spends 11 hours testifying in front of a congressional committee, he can talk to me about stamina.
The world, let me tell you, Hillary has experience, but it's bad experience. We have made so many bad deals during the last... So she's got experience, that I agree, but it's bad, bad experience. Whether it's the Iran deal that you're so in love with, where we gave them $150 billion back, whether it's the Iran deal, whether it's anything you could... You almost can't name a good deal. I agree. She's got experience, but it's bad experience. And this country can't afford to have another 4 years of that kind of experience.
We are at the... We're at the final question.
One thing, Lester, is, he tried to switch from looks to stamina, but this is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs, and someone who has said pregnancy is an inconvenience to employers, who has said women don't deserve equal pay unless they do as good a job as men. And one of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them. And he called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her?
Her name is Alicia Machado. Where did you find her?
And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good. Let me just tell you.
Mrs. Trump, please take 10 seconds, and then we're going to have a final question.
Hillary is hitting me with tremendous commercials. Some of it said in entertainment. Some of it said somebody who's been very vicious to me, Rosie O'Donnell. I said very tough things to her, and I think everybody would agree that she deserves it, and nobody feels sorry for her. But you want to know the truth? I was going to say something extremely rough to Hillary, to her family, and I said to myself, I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's inappropriate. It's not nice. But she spent hundreds of millions of dollars on negative ads on me, many of which are absolutely untrue. They're untrue and they're misrepresentations. And I will tell you this, Lester, it's not nice, and I don't deserve that. But it's certainly not a nice thing that she's done. It's hundreds of millions of ads. And the only gratifying thing is I saw the polls come in today. And with all of that money, over $200 million is spent, and I'm either winning or tied, and I've spent practically nothing.
Notice how every time that Donald Trump wants to finish a sentence to make a point, he's interrupted by Lester Holt. And he only did that to Hillary maybe six times, to the 61 times he did it throughout the debate to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was going to restrain himself, talking about the escapades of Bill Clinton, talking about the things he was guilty of, the many affairs, the many things when he was governor of Arkansas, how Hillary defended him and trashed the women that he raped and that he did sexual things too. We know those things. He could have went down that direction, and he chose not to. So we will see in debate number two on October 9th here in St. Louis just exactly how things will change, if he will be a little bit more aggressive and not miss the opportunities he had there. She talked about equal pay. When she was in the Senate, women only made 72 cents to the dollar. In the Clinton Foundation, men are paid 38% more than women. Donald could have went to those areas and talked and challenged her on those. He didn't. I think those are missed opportunities. I think things will get better in debate number two. What I want to do with our last 15 minutes to shift from the debate now to the historic election that's coming up, I want to talk about an issue with you that I think is very, very important. And it's about our vote and the sovereignty of God. And this is a biblical issue, but it's an important issue that we need to understand. And when I say sovereignty of God, what am I talking about? Well, sovereignty means that God, as the ruler of the universe, he has the right to do whatever he wants. Further, he is in complete control of everything that happens. And this is a very biblical doctrine, and I want to talk about how that relates to the upcoming election. A lot of people will think, well, it's just a crapshoot. It's whatever happens, you know, whatever happens in the universe. Well, you know, it's just luck or chance. No, not according to the sovereignty of God. The Bible says our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. And so he is in control. And I want to go over this very carefully with you because especially I'm talking to the Christians. We may think when we go to vote, you know, and we cast our vote, does that really make a difference? And yes, of course, according to history, it does make a difference. But I want to explore this with you because I think it's something very, very important for us to understand. And we look at our government and we see a lot of corruption. And this time of year with the election going on, we think of politicians, we think of corruption, we think of injustices, we think of things that are happening, and we ask, why God? What's going to happen in the future? What happens when we go to the voting booths on November 8th? Well, if we understand from the Bible, government is a gift from God, but it's also controlled by God. And we look in the scriptures, Daniel chapter 4. Verse 17 says, the Most High, that is God, rules the kingdom of men, and that he, that is God, gives it to whom he wills and sets over it the lowliest of men. And so it seems to me there that government power is very important. It exists, and God has put it there. Even in the corrupted state that it is, even in the injustices that it is, the Bible never endorses the injustices and corruptions. And even the sinful shenanigans of human beings are never outside of God's control. His purpose will be accomplished, and he will even use the wicked to accomplish his purposes. Man did not have anything to do with creating government. God did. Man does not sustain government. God does. Civil authority is God's plan for our age. So if we look at the scriptures and the sovereignty of God, we can see that God is absolutely sovereign and authoritative over who rules, over who they are, how they got their authority, and he is sovereign over how long they rule. Let me give you some examples from the Bible. God is sovereign over who rules, where they exercise their power, over whom they have authority, and how long. God spoke to one of the most wicked, powerful rulers in human history, the Pharaoh of Egypt, and said, for this purpose, I have raised you up to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. Notice God says of Pharaoh, I raised you up for this purpose to show you my power and greatness and so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. Another example, Daniel spoke to the corrupt and barbaric King Nebuchadnezzar over Babylon and said, quote, blessed be the name of the God of heaven forever and ever, to whom belongs wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Daniel chapter 2, verse 20. There, according to the Holy Scriptures, Daniel, looking in the face of Nebuchadnezzar, says, he removes kings, O Nebuchadnezzar. He sets up kings. He changes times and seasons. Later on, Daniel would say to the same to Belshazzar, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. He gave it, and he also took it away. So what we see here is that God is active in history, setting up and removing kings. Another great example is what Jesus said to Pontius Pilate, who, if you look at that whole situation, seemed to have the fate of Jesus in his own hands. When Pilate says to Jesus, "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" What did Jesus say? Jesus says to Pilate, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above." And so he's reminding Pilate, "You don't have my fate in your hands. The Almighty God of the universe does. And if he is giving you any authority, it's because he's giving it to you, not because you have it yourself intrinsically." Jeroboam was one of the most wicked kings of Israel. And we read in 1 Kings 12:15, this political intrigue. It says it was a turn of events brought about by the Lord. So God is responsible for the establishment of every governmental authority. He must of necessity be also responsible for the disestablishment of it all. Say he removes kings and sets up kings. Here is another very powerful verse under supporting the authority and the sovereignty of God, reminding you and me of who's ultimately in control of all affairs, who's in control of this universe and the events and the election we're about to participate in. It says in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 23 through 24, "He brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth when he blows on them and they wither and the tempest carries them off like stubble." That's how our sovereign God is in control. He is not only sovereign in that he decides who shall rule and for how long, but he also is sovereign over their influence, their power. He also has authority over the hearts and minds of kings and the president to what he wants done. Listen to the scriptures again, Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 30. "But Sihon, the king of Heshbon, would not let us pass by him, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, so that he might give him unto your hand as he is this day." So God can harden the hearts. It says in Proverbs 21:1, "The king's heart," that is the ruler, the president, "is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wills." Wow. That's true of presidents, senators, congressmen, governors, and mayors. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wills. Again, another example. In the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, in order that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. Notice how the Lord can influence the hearts of kings and governors and presidents to accomplish his purpose and his will. "Blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who put such a thing in the heart of the king to beautify the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem." He put something into the heart of the king to accomplish his purpose. So all authority and rule and governorship comes from God. Love what it says in Acts chapter 4, as the early Christians were proclaiming the gospel of Jesus and were out sharing the good news. It says, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus," this is a prayer, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Let me say again, God put it in the hearts of these rulers to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. It was God who stirred up Nebuchadnezzar to launch an assault on Israel, and it was God who determined the outcome of the battle. Gives, the Lord takes away. And as we look at this, what is our responsibility? Our responsibility is outlined in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 2, that we are to pray, that supplications, prayer, intercessions, and thanksgiving may be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions. Why do we pray? That we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. We are to pray that the Most High God would stir their spirits, move upon their hearts, change their thinking, shape their character, and entice them to enact legislation. Why? To accomplish what is most beneficial for the church, for the world. So we, as kingdom citizens, are to pray. We have a responsibility. This is not a puppet thing where God is using these people as puppets. No, not at all. The divine sovereignty and the human will is a difficult doctrine to understand, but it is like a hand in the glove. We have a responsibility to vote. We have a responsibility to speak out against social injustices. We have a responsibility to be involved in politics. Look at Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar, how he was involved. We are responsible to do all of those things. And at the same time, we are responsible to pray. And God is sovereign over everything. This should help us in what we do on November 8th, to understand that in spite of everything, God is in control, and yet we have a responsibility to do our part by voting on November 8th. I want us to sum up everything we said with this song by Chris Tomlin that summarizes everything I've taught you this morning about sovereignty. This is Chris Tomlin in a song called Sovereign.
Sovereign on the ocean floor, with me in the cold.
song of comfort, a song of hope, a very thought-provoking song by Chris Tomlin from Burning Lights to summarize what we've been talking about here on The Cross in the Desert today. Ultimately, no matter what happens on November 8th, one thing is for sure, from everything I've read to you from the Bible and explained, that God is in control. And we have a responsibility to vote. We have a responsibility to speak out. We have a responsibility as Christians. But one thing for sure, no matter what, our God is in control. This is a message of comfort, a message of hope. And I thank you so much for spending time with me today on The Cross in the Desert on this very important program about the election and the election debate. Thank you so much, Vito, for coming into the chat room today and sharing your thoughts with me. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming on today and being educated and instructed. I will see you next time on The Cross in the Desert again on Monday. Have yourself an incredible weekend. We'll see you then.
Great.